I'm Bill Rice, and our session today is on faith and science. I tried to think of a clever title, and I couldn't, but anyway, I thought that was exciting enough. I would be curious to see among us who of you are involved in the sciences professionally, are a scientist or an engineer or are studying science. Oh, we have a number, okay. And who is professionally in the field of religion, either in your studies or you're working as a pastor or something, okay. And who, anybody raise their hands twice? Okay, and all, anyone not raise their hands? Well, I'm with you because I'm neither professionally in the sciences nor in the field of religion. But I've been fascinated with these issues ever since high school, when I had decided that I was going to be a astrophysicist, and also was very much interested in the ministry. And so I thought that I had the whole relationship between faith and science put together then, and that's when I should have taught this course, because ever since then things have become more and more confused. The issues are really very elaborate, and we are going to deal with just an extremely small portion of what could be put under this rubric. We're going to deal with some basic principles as to what our Christian faith is and how it relates to the principles of investigation that go under what we consider to be modern science. So a lot of things we're not going to deal with are specific issues such as creationism, and we're very fortunate that we will be dealing with that later. In fact, I'll be expecting input from all of you, but particularly from Erling and Tom and Bill. I'm sorry. Bill, I'm confused here. There are issues also having to do with the way in which technological decisions and research decisions are made and how our faith informs the decision-making bodies in our society about what is going to be funded for research. There are also issues governing who has access to technology, who has access to scientific education, who meaning what countries, what groups within a country. Do we export all our technology, or do we try to prevent some of our high tech from being exported to other countries? Those kinds of issues. The distribution of technology, science education, questions of money for funding scientific enterprises, and so on, all of which our faith has something to say about. And yet these are issues which we may get into in the discussion time later or this evening during the forum. They're not where we're going to start. We're going to start on the specific relationship between the methodologies of faith and science. Now that may sound funny to talk about the methodology of faith. Would like to share with you, this is a clipping that's on the wall in the dining hall. Reagan to evangelists, use your pulpits to fight nuke arms freeze. A couple of excerpts. President Reagan called on evangelical church leaders today to use their pulpits against opponents of his defense buildup and those who would place the United States in a position of military and moral inferiority. Reagan told the church leaders that, quote, in your discussions of the nuclear freeze proposals, I urge you to beware of the temptation of pride. He described this as the temptation blithely to declare yourselves above it all and label both sides equally to fault, to ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding and thereby remove yourselves from the struggle between right and wrong, good and evil. I urge you to speak out against those who would place the United States in a position of military and moral inferiority. Now, what's of particular interest here is he is saying, church, don't be aloof from the issues. Your concerns are not strictly religious, but your faith has something to inform our society about in terms of social and political action. What that direction what that specific mandate is to the church may be a little different from what we feel, but it's very interesting to see there's a recognition here that issues of science and technology are informed by our stance on the faith, even if we choose to say that faith is a separate issue. Let's start off by looking just a little bit at what faith is. If we think of marriage, what is a marriage? What's the first word that comes to your mind from marriage?
Relationship.
Oh, you hit the jackpot. I was hoping someone would say that. It's a relationship. Now, can anyone describe the relationship? Some descriptors.
Compromise.
Compromise.
Fulfillment.
Love.
Commitment.
Trust. Okay, that's good. Notice we're talking at two different levels. We say that the thing itself is a relationship, and then we can describe the relationship and give descriptors for it. Well, I think so also with faith, that our faith fundamentally is a relationship with Christ. And then we can step back and we can talk about it, and we can describe it, and we can analyze it, and we can theologize about it, and we can create creeds that describe what that relationship is and state the mighty acts of God and how we fit into those. What is science then? Is science comparable to a description of the universe, or is science comparable to a relationship?
Yes.
Good. On that note of profundity, we will continue. Just what science is and how that relates then to this fundamental relationship that we have of faith is something that we'll look at a number of models of. And I think that we will find that what our understanding of science is and what our understanding of faith is changes as we look at various models of the way they interact or don't interact. The first model, oh, my blackboard moved. I'm tethered here. Again. Science alone is adequate to deal with reality. Now, a few of us today would actually say that in the present state of the sciences that we have covered our ability to handle all of the world's problems. And yet, if we look at the history of science over the last several years, particularly since the 17th century, use Newton as a key pivotal point, we can see that beginning with Newton, actually with his predecessors, we are gradually bringing the phenomena of the world that we observe under an understanding of law and under an understanding of regularity. That with Newton, we now are able to describe the motions of the planets as well as the motions of things on Earth. The motion in the pure, perfect realm up above in the heavens, as well as the motions in this imperfect realm, with the same set of laws, the laws of motion and the law of gravitation. And that we gradually have, since Newton, a working out of laws applicable to a wide variety of phenomena that we observe, from atoms to planets, then to chemical relationships, to psychology and to sociology, and although these sciences, we would say, are hardly sciences in the same sense as physics, still we're trying to move in the direction of establishing regularities, dependable explanations of the universe that no longer require any recourse to a living, deciding, active, moving being pulling the strings. It is quite possible then to say that although we're not there yet, that science continually moving in this direction will provide further and further explanations for all the phenomena around us, and will therefore equip us with the tools to make all our own decisions. It is quite unnecessary for us to have any recourse to a deity. It is nice to think of a deity as perhaps symbolizing certain values of equality, of freedom, of compassion, of love, but that doesn't mean that she or he actually has to exist. It merely is a conceptual framework that we can utilize for concepts that that we choose to value and which science will eventually prove to be of value to us. So that is one quite possible stance in this whole issue, is to say that faith is a remnant of superstition and beliefs which served a purpose in past times, which helped people to formulate and understand their world, but is no longer relevant. Does anyone want to opt for this model? Not yet. Okay, well, let's look at quite another model. That faith alone is quite adequate as a guide to life. Now, obviously, the Bible doesn't address a lot of issues that we face in our daily lives, and it doesn't address directly a lot of issues in our society. But nevertheless, from this stance, we say that it is faith that is really the important thing, the really essential thing. Science may be interesting, but faith is what we base our life on. I think one place that we see this stance quite frequently is in the area of medicine and healing. A close friend was telling me the story of one of his friends who had an incurable type of cancer, had been in the hospital for months and months, and his condition had been deteriorating. Doctors had said this was terminal, it was just a matter of time. The person had gone into a coma, and they were just, all the relatives were expecting death at any time. It was the death watch time. This person was a member of a church that believed very strongly in the power of prayer. And when members of the church learned of the fellow's condition, they held prayer services, and they went and visited the person and prayed with him in the hospital. The entire church was mobilized through telephone chains and so on to pray continually for this person's healing. And the person did very suddenly come out of the coma and surprised all of the doctors with an incredible remission in the cancer, and within a matter of a few days was able to return home, and has since shown no signs of relapse. Now, the person who was telling me this was saying two things, really. On the one hand, he was saying, look at the enormous power of God, which we, and the blessing and the grace of God that has been manifested here in this healing. And that I could affirm with him. And that, in fact, the doctors could affirm with him, who were as mystified by the sudden recovery as anyone else. But there's another dimension to what this fellow was saying. It was a hidden dimension, but it was a very real one. And that is, look how inadequate the sciences are. Look how powerless all of modern medicine was compared to the healing power of God. And where this dimension gets really exemplified is groups such as you may have heard just about a week ago on the news, church called Faith Assembly Church that has come to our attention because several of their members, particularly something like 27 children, died because the church refuses to use any medical, to use doctors or any medication at all. They feel that all health and healing is the province of God and should be prayed for and sought directly from God and not through the sciences. So there is a feeling on the part of a large number of people that the science is at best not a contribution to life and to life in the spirit, and at worst it is a demonic force, something to be shunned and something to be rejected. Anyone want to opt for that position before we move on? I won't have you vote for all of them, but
did believe in medicine.
That's true. That's true. And we would distinguish that approach from the approach of something like
the
Faith Assembly Church.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Good point. Third option is that faith and science deal with separate realities altogether. That science deals with the material world, faith deals with the spiritual world. And this is an argument which is used often to support the slogan, the separation of church and state. The church concerns itself with matters of the spirit, state concerns itself with other matters that are not of the spirit. In fact, it might be against such a position that Reagan was speaking here when he's saying that the church has, or people of faith, have something to say about social issues. The implication of the separate realities is that for the first 6 days, God was working in the province of the state, and for the last day, he was working in the province of the church. this is a position which is very easy to take, particularly when there are very difficult and nasty social issues around, ones that our faith, if they were to address, might suggest very difficult options. And we can see that there was some of this attitude, some of this strong feeling of separation, which was significant in the German church during the 30s and allowed for the rise of Nazism. Another approach is to say that our realities are really one. We are not split between a material and a spiritual universe, but that faith and science ask different questions. Different questions about the same reality. Take creation, for example. This stance would say, no, of course Genesis is not interested in teaching us geology and biology. We do not look to the first chapter of Genesis to ask how long it took to have the earth formed and what was the order of creation and so on and so forth. This position says that the how, exactly how creation occurred, is the province of science. And we can rely on science to investigate those kinds of questions, while we rely on our faith to ask why questions. What does all of this mean? What is creation here for? And why are we here? This is a very appealing position, and it was a position that I held for a long period of time, because particularly in biblical study, it keeps us from getting sidetracked from the real heart of the biblical message. If we get wrapped up in arguments about whether the earth was created in 7 days or created in 5 billion years, we find that we have totally missed the impact that the writers of Genesis felt, the awe that they felt at creation, the mystery that man was created with such an important place in all of the creation. And So this is appealing in that it allows us to focus our questions of the faith upon issues which are deeply and importantly relevant to us. There is also a problem with it, and that is that such an approach handicaps both the scientist and the person of faith. Routine science might be concerned with finding out facts, but the truly great movements and developments within any scientific discipline are those which have probed the why question. We can see this in the Copernican Revolution. We can see this with the revolution of relativity. We can see that questions of just how do things progress and how have things gone along are not sufficient. We'll get into the structure of how scientific endeavors occur in a little bit. I'll mention here an issue that's been developing out of studies of astronomy and studies of physics at the most fundamental and most theoretical levels, having to do with why we have the universe that we do. One of the problems, very serious problem for theoreticians, is how could we have the present mixture in the universe of galaxies, and within galaxies of star clusters and so on. Well, you can have clusters of galaxies, first of all, and then galaxies and star clusters and planetary systems around stars and so on, from a theoretical Big Bang. It seems that there are extreme of the enormous possible arrangements of matter at the time of the Big Bang, that an extremely specific arrangement would be required to create the universe that we now have. An extremely improbable arrangement. Very slight variations, one way or another, would send the universe into a great mass of evenly distributed dispersed gas. Or, on the other hand, such an array of black holes that we would never even see galaxies and planetary systems. Not only that, but the origins of life itself are extremely improbable, given all the possibilities that could have occurred in the universe. So one of the theories that is seriously proposed is called the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle says that one of the requirements in the development of the universe was that it develop in such a way that eventually it would generate a form of consciousness that could be aware of it. In other words, that one of the requirements at the beginning of time was that the development of the universe reach a point where there was human life that was reflective and could look back on it and discover it. Now that sounds far more like a religious stance than a stance coming from science. But this gives a feeling for how at the frontiers of any scientific endeavor, questions of why become as essential as questions of how. And the opposite problem is also opposite case is also a problem. This is a problem for men of faith to say that our concern is only with the why, because that would lead us to saying, all right, we'll relegate to science the responsibility for discovering how the world is structured and how human nature is structured and how societies function within each other, and we'll let then science set up society. Our job will be to explain why it's the best of all possible worlds. Back to, again, the rise of movements such as Nazism. After knocking all of these things down, I ask you to vote for them. You're going to be stuck with the last one. Okay, let's look at another possibility, interaction. Faith informs the sciences. Science informs faith. St. Paul writes, "Who will deliver me from this body of death? The good that I want to do, I do not do, and the very evil things that I abhor, I find myself doing." Profound insight. An insight which has many, many years later been elucidated by men such as Sigmund Freud, who have essentially stated the same thing, and stated the same thing in a rationalistic framework, providing concepts such as id, ego, and superego to give explanation to what St. Paul has said himself. And I think it's not unfair to say that the wisdom of the scriptures in the community of faith, in the community of influenced life understandings within Western society, which in turn prompted questions which Freud raised. Faith can inform the direction in which a scientific pursuit is undertaken. And the opposite is also true. We have a far deeper understanding, for example, of what Paul really meant when he was talking about the role of women in the church, and women covering their heads and so on and so forth, by our scientific investigations and our archaeological investigations of the society of Paul's day. And that's even more true of Hebraic culture. We can understand far better what the significance of some of the stories, such as the flood and other early Genesis traditions, are to the Hebrew people by discovering the Enuma Elish legend among the Babylonians and the Sumerians and so on and so forth, and these other traditions. The application of science has helped us to understand the special thrusts and special directions and special spirit and insight that we have in the community of the Hebrew people. However, this appears to be only a sporadic and occasional kind of contact between faith and science. Yes, we can find some archaeological examples, and yes, we can find some things in the area of psychology and perhaps in sociology as well, where there is contact. But certainly we would not be expecting to find major problems in the area of medicine, in the area of physics and chemistry, in the area of astronomy, to be informed by a careful study of Scripture. There are a few writers who seem to be able to write with a very sharp and disciplined scientific approach, and at the same time, highly informed by their faith. And I'd like to read you a short selection from one of them. It's Lauren Isley, The Immense Journey. He's written a number of other things. I'm not sure what Isley's field is. Does anyone happen to know what Lauren Isley is? It's in the biological sciences, but I'm not precisely sure. Like Carl Sagan, before he became popular, he was a disciplined scientist. Lauren Isley. The sun was warm there, and the murmurs of the forest life blurred softly away into my sleep. When I awoke, dimly aware of some commotion and outcry in the clearing, the light was slanting down through the pines in such a way that the glade was lit like some vast cathedral. I could see the dust motes of wood pollen in the long shaft of light, and there on the extended branch sat an enormous raven with a red and squirming nestling in its beak. The sound that awoke me was the outraged cries of the nestling's parents, who flew helplessly in circles about the clearing. The sleek black monster was indifferent to them. He gulped, wetted his beak on the dead branch a moment, and sat still. Up to that point, the little tragedy had followed the usual pattern. But suddenly, out of all that area of woodland, a soft sound of complaint began to rise. Into the glade fluttered small birds of half a dozen varieties, drawn by the anguished outcries of the tiny parents. No one dared to attack the raven, but they cried there in some instinctive common misery, the bereaved and the unbereaved. The glade filled with their soft rustling and their cries. They fluttered as to point their wings at the murderer. There was a dim, intangible ethic he had violated, and they knew. He was a bird of death. And he, the murderer, the black bird at the heart of life, sat on there, glistening in the common light, formidable, unmoving, unperturbed, untouchable. The sighing died. It was then that I saw the judgment. It was the judgment of life against death. I will never see it again so forcefully presented. I will never hear it again in notes so tragically prolonged, for in the midst of protest, they forgot the violence. There in that clearing, the crystal note of a song sparrow lifted hesitantly in the hush. And finally, after painful fluttering, another took the song, and then another, the song passing from one bird to another, doubtfully at first, as though some evil thing were being slowly forgotten, till suddenly they took heart and sang from many throats, joyously together, as birds are known to sing. They sang because life is sweet and sunlight beautiful. They sang under the brooding shadow of the raven. In simple truth, they had forgotten the raven, for they were the singers of life and not of death. If our faith could grow to the point where in any pursuit we would see the strong dimensions of God's grace and redemption, even as we are studying molecules bouncing around, we would surely have a beautiful vision. That's to wake up the people listening to the paper. Okay, we'll have to find another system here. Languages. Faith and science are conceptual languages. All of us have heard the illustration of the Eskimos, many words for snow, 20 or more words for snow. There's pellet snow, and there's wet snow, and there's dry, flaky snow, and there's blowing snow, and there's snow on the ground, and so on and so forth. But with more than 20 words for snow, we can be quite sure that the Eskimos are attuned to noticing the subtle nuances of snow that we would never notice. And so it is with any language. A language attunes us to be aware of and to be sensitive to be able to respond to and communicate about things that persons who don't share that language cannot. How many of you have studied another language? Okay. Have you all felt that? That revelation of whole new ways of seeing things that you'd never noticed in English. Well, think of science and faith then, potentially, in this additional model, as languages. Faith is a language which talks about God, talks about the other, talks about that than which nothing is greater, as the medieval writers used to say. The other against whom we have, the other to us. Also speaks of his coming to us, of redemption, of love, of grace, of total undeservedness on our part. Faith as a language then can elucidate certain experiences and certain realities, not only individually, but as a whole community, can provide an opportunity for a community to become something, to become the body of Christ itself, which without that language would not be thinkable in secular society. Science has its language, the language of hypothesis and analysis, a language which can draw our attention to and focus our attention upon an extremely minute event and make us make us concentrate our attention on something that appears anomalous until we find a consistent way of integrating it into our universe. And so science can open up possibilities for us to create electronic chips with extremely complex circuitry on them, which without the language of science in the first place wouldn't exist, and if they did, would be swept away with the dust. So that as conceptual languages, faith opens up to us a reality, opens up to us a possibility for life, which otherwise is not there. And science opens a possibility for life, which is not there. And both then are extremely powerful. Now, in recent times, we've become more, as a culture, we've become more impressed with the power of science than we have with the power of faith. And often the bastions of faith see themselves not as a powerful group opening up and eliciting new meanings and new possibilities for our world and our nation, but rather as a group that's trying desperately to hang on to some old traditions. So we have some problems with seeing faith and with science strictly as languages. We recognize their enormous power. We recognize that because of their power, they must relate somehow. But how do you relate one language to another? How do you translate one into another? A major problem. All of this is meant to prompt discussion later on, so we'll... If you feel frustrated being left hanging, then help us come down later on. Another option, faith and science as similar disciplines. Now this is particularly interesting because we began by saying that faith itself is fundamentally the relationship. And then we can attach descriptors to that relationship in the same way that we can talk about marriage as a relationship, and then we can describe what it's like. Bishop Anselm, in his famous book, Cur Deus Homo, was constantly saying, faith seeks understanding. We don't prove our beliefs rationally. We begin by knowing of a certainty of God's love. And then we try to make sense out of that. We try to make what we know in our hearts acceptable to our minds. We see that in everyday relationships. We know our parents loved us. Well, how do we know it? We know it. We have known love from other people. Fundamentally, that is where we begin. Now we can look back and that we can analyze and say, yes, I knew my parents loved me because, they changed my dirty diapers and they took care of me and they brought me up and they spent a whole lot of money on me and they sent me to school, so on and so forth. And what we're doing there is theology. We are making rational sense out of something that we would never be able to deny. And so faith begins with something that we cannot deny. And then in theology, we attempt to make some kind of rational sense out of that. So theology constantly changes because what is acceptable to our minds in one era is not in another, and so on and so forth. So theology must continually grow. This also means that the creeds must continually grow and the interpretation of the creeds. Science is much the same way. And this is a fact which is not generally recognized, or I guess it would be recognized, but generally not thought of by the common public, that science begins with a faith stance, or a variety of faith stances. And the great effort of science is to make rational and to draw out the implications of those stances. If any of you want to explore that aspect of science further, I strongly recommend Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He, among and other people, have shown how the pursuit of science is really the pursuit of the current dogma, Newtonian physics for years was the application of the basic laws of motion and the law of gravitation to a wide, wide range of phenomena. And that and other derivative theories and related theories, in the process of being applied to one field after another, occasionally there are certain anomalies that crop up. One of the more dramatic ones in the field of physics was the apparent conflict between the wave theory of light and the photon or particle theory of light. While I won't go into detail on that, it seemed that it was quite possible through the most rigorous application of all of the physical derivative laws from Newton to prove conclusively that light was a wave. It was also possible to prove that light was not a wave, but was a particle. And it was such an anomaly like that, which then attracted a great deal of attention from the scientific community. And because, and in the pursuit of that, some of the basic principles of Newton's laws were overthrown. We have the scientific revolution of relativity. And we have a whole new series of principles. But the pursuit of science was the carrying out of a faith stance. Now, that occurs at two levels. One, there is the faith that Einstein very famously expressed, God does not play dice with the universe. That's what he said when he heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Heisenberg said that we can never say anything definitive about the location of a subatomic particle for two reasons. One is that if we measure it, we've already moved it. And two is because there is, and this is more important, there is no such thing as a true statement about the location and the velocity of any subatomic particle. The only truth is a probability. Einstein didn't care for that at all, because one of Einstein's faith stances was that God does not play dice with the universe. And there's been a great debate in the physical world over this, and quantum mechanics has had to come up with new dependable foundations for the faith of science. Faith of science, isn't that interesting? So both, from this standpoint, both faith and science are confessional disciplines. Both begin with statements which are not challenged and seek to work out the ramifications and the implications of those. Job had faith in the dependability of God's justice. And through all the storms in his life and all the terrible things that happened to him and all the recommendations of his friends to say, hey, it's not very good to question God and challenge God, Job said, I demand of you, God, an explanation, because I believe that you are just and fair, and I haven't done anything wrong. Very scientific approach, an approach of faith. Einstein, in his reluctance to accept the uncertainty principle and some of early quantum mechanics, because of his faith stance that it's not fair to say that God only deals in probabilities and not in realities.
Science and investigation of our world today will confirm the validity and the truth of the scriptures as they relate to past history and as they relate to the prophecies of the future. Black holes are predicted in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation. So this approach goes. Science will confirm scripture. The anthropic principle could also be, that we talked about earlier, could also be related under this approach. Well, I'm going to leave it right there and open it up for discussion. We've looked at a variety of models, and are there places where you want to jump in? Yes.
Yeah, I went one way with that last one, but it worked the other way. Faith confirming plan.
I suppose we could go back to Freud and St. Paul and this dilemma of will. And we could look at that in either direction.
Except that Paul did admit and believe in another kind of entity besides just the person's will. In the story of the slave girl, where he cast the demon of divination out of her, if I understand what you're saying now, Freud's understanding of that would be that there was something in the girl's makeup, that she herself totally was responsible for her gift. If you know the story I'm talking about, the slave girl would follow Paul, and the disciples kept saying, this is the man of God, here you him, and she was used by the wealthy men of this town to tell them how to invest their money. And Paul put up with it for about 3 days, and then he whirled on her and said, come out of her, you spirit of divination. And she lost the gift, and they ran Paul and the other disciples out of town. So I don't think Paul and Freud are exactly alike.
No.
Freud would not admit to a demonic entity.
I'm not sure, though, how that relates. What would it mean if faith were to confirm science in the integration model?
I'm not thinking that. I'm thinking that you brought up Freud and Paul and how they were
yes.
very similar. And I'm saying
so maybe that is the relevant example.
I'm saying not totally.
Yeah.
Okay. I think, you know, with the faith in science, if you believe that God is a God of regularity, of predictability, of an order, and if you find that in certain areas of science where predictability, I think, is the hallmark or the key, then I think, you know, with that kind of connection, I think you've got an overlap between the two, because that's the argument by that design. Only the God that the Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, professes, only that kind of God could have created this world of order and stability and predictability.
I guess what that leaves out in the cold, then, is the way in which the Bible talks about the mighty acts of God and the specific actions of God throughout history.
Now, the Hebrew mind wasn't interested in, you know, in science at all. The Greeks wanted argument, the Jews wanted miracle. And the Hebrews were used to that because God had spoken to them through the burning bush, through the Exodus and all the rest, and that's how God acted to them.
Mm.
And so they weren't interested in, they knew that God would make with ease the God of mighty hands. And that's what was, you know, confirmed their faith in him, but he hadn't deserted them. You know, they had pledged themselves to the covenant. But therefore, every so often, wouldn't it be nice if Yahweh would send down a new miracle or something just to keep in touch? Because, there was long lapse in the room. I think that's true.
I once heard an archaeologist say that no self-respecting archaeologist goes into the Holy Land doing digging without taking a Bible. He's the agnostic, atheist, or believer. Because there have been so many times they have used, scientists have used the Bible to try to find, for instance, Jacob's well. They found it by using totally physical directions in the Bible and some other things.
Mm-hmm.
When they were just sure that it didn't exist and that it, and they not only found out that it did, but that it was the way the city had been evacuated, they found out through that.
There's a whole book on it, Werner Calvary's classroom. The Bible is archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
He's a status that beyond anyhow. I mean, atheists or agnostics don't, that's not a question for them any longer.
That's right.
In Israel, right? And the most of the mighty deeds can be, you know, can be documented by archaeology.
And then it also goes the other way, I think, in Paul's second missionary journey. That can't be traced at all.
Yeah,
it's going from one place to another, and it just isn't possible that it could have taken place that way. And there, Luke is writing from a faith perspective, the point again, the awe, and the magnanimity.
I'd just like to ask a question about that. Why could it not be possible? Because in that day he could not have traveled that, or what is it? Mm-hmm.
He goes, from great distances in just a very short amount of time, and all sorts of crazy.
Then what do you do with the biblical account of Philip, who was taken up by the Spirit and delivered where was it? You know, after preaching to the Ethiopian, he was taken up by the Spirit. Where is it? I know a minister friend, whenever he gets into a mess or doesn't want to get into it, he says, God, please transport me immediately out of this meeting. I mean, I'm just saying.
That would be possible, but the way it's written.
Be miraculous, yeah.
Which Philip doesn't just say, he just taken up by.
Right, and I've never heard what you're saying, so I think that's kind of interesting.
One of the things that's bothered me for a long time is that when we find ourselves in predicaments where of pollution and all of these things, that shall we say science, quote unquote, has gotten us into, there's so much shrugging of the shoulders and saying, oh well, science will find a way to get us out of it. And I just don't think that that's the job of science, to get us out of it.
In fact, it seems like science gets us into it. The more scientific development, the more ethical and faith questions there are that are raised.
Bad, it seems like with every technological advance, we bring at least a problem, an equal problem.
Right.
I think you can.
And I think a lot of those problems can only be solved by faith. The bomb and the great things that are facing. I don't think science is going to solve our problems. No. I think faith will solve our problems.
I think it's a whole another discussion to try to distinguish between science, which you've been talking about all this time, and technology developments. They're related, but they aren't the same thing anymore. Than science and faith would be the same thing, although I think you've shown very well that there are relationships between them.
That may be a tack that you want to take tonight. We left tonight very open-ended, thought, we'll lay down some problems this afternoon, and then that may be a direction that we'll want to pursue. Yeah.
Is it a science question or a faith question to say just because we can do it, we should? I mean, that's where I think we get into a lot of trouble, because just because we can doesn't mean that we should, in my opinion. But I,
And the interesting thing about that is that of course, our first reaction to that might be, well, science is amoral. Science is merely the uncovering of facts and the opening up of possibilities. And the decisions about how those possibilities are going to be utilized lie outside the realm of science. But that is increasingly coming under attack, and people are saying, no, that isn't true at all. After all, scientists are human beings. And they're not just major decisions about how we utilize technology, but every step of the way in an investigation, there is the forming vision of what is it that I'm trying to discover? What is it that I'm trying to reveal? And what are the implications of that? And how does that relate to the overall endeavor that I'm a part of?
And certainly genetic manipulation would come in.
But see, now you're dealing with a big argument within the scientific community itself as to whether scientists are accountable or not. That would be the text of the Sunday's National Scientific Convention in Chicago about 3 years ago. As to, how accountable is it, neutral, and should it just be they investigate facts and then they leave it up to the religious people and the ethicists of how these things are handled, or are they accountable? And that's a question that the scientific community itself does not settle, and I don't think they will. Because for them to settle it, you have to put them all into one camp. And how do you do that?
A lot of
the theologians in this.
I was reported after the training camp, I mean, the theologians and the scientists, don't they say things to each other? They come back to your languages, but can't we talk to each other?
I don't know. Did I mention this? The 3 years ago, there was a conference in Boston, World Council of Churches conference on faith, science, and the future, and they came up with this doctrine. It's 2 volumes. Fascinating reading. And what they did was they brought together scientists and science students and leaders in the area of technology applications from all over the world, together with theologians and church leaders and leaders in other faiths as well besides Christians, brought them together and studied many of these issues they were discussing, and also went on to discuss the technological issues and the issues of justice and fairness and the distribution of science and technology applications and so on and so forth. And there was a great deal of excitement at that event, and there have been some studies that have followed up on that. You might be interested in reading some of the reports that came out. I believe that this is in our library. Thank you.
I suspect it is. I was going to say I was there, and I was thinking tonight of quoting Ruben Alves' response to the discussion on the nature of science. We listened to some discussion.
Very good. Very good. Do you want to do that now, or do you want to?
No, that's the other question.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, is there any other burning thing that you want to share now, or shall we continue later this evening?
You made one statement which I think is interesting, and I'm just going to put back at you and not comment much on it, but I think it's profound, and that is mankind of different heritage, people kind of whatever. If you want to press with science and faith, and I think about that, that's really very true. So people are so impressed with what's happening in science, and so unimpressed with what's happening in faith. And the faith is a question of the church itself.
I would like to ask you again, just because I'm absolutely unscientific, explain to me again this
anthropic principle?
Yes, I have a theory that development of the universe was in such a way that it finally developed a consciousness that could look back and discover. Is that simple? That takes more faith than I've got, period. That's what I find amazing, is that
coming
sometimes
straight out of
take
the study.
More faith, you know, than faith.
That's a crucial to a lot of the book. I mean, many of the things there, I mean, the great discoveries are really based on faith, and how much pressure there is among scientists to accept a certain model, and how much courage it takes for somebody to break away from the model.
It's like standing in a net and swallowing a camel.
The anthropic principle, I ran across it in an article in Scientific American about a year ago. And I don't recall now the names of the physicists who were attached to that, but it was not a single person. It was a field of thought, or a school of thought that was emerging.
One thing I noticed, or I've been thinking about, is that science, at least where it hits the road for me, it doesn't stop with questions. It doesn't stop with questions, it stops with statements. And faith seems to be more having questions. In relation to this anthropomorphic and that would be a model to use. So then you talk about how things got set up that way and where does where it all came from or anything like that.
That's true.
And then the shock is to find some scientists who are so lucid. When we were Thomas' student at Michigan, we became friends because his wife is a musician, was a scientist who had developed a fast way for our submarines to submerge and emerge, which our armed forces use. And he's a very brilliant man. And one night at a dinner party, he totally put our place in shambles because someone came up, a theologian, as a matter of fact, with the idea that there might be something that was faster than the speed of light. And he just got furious and said he couldn't associate that evening with such ignorant people. And he demanded that his wife get her coat and go home with him. It was just so terrible, you know. Here he is. I mean, you think of a scientist as someone who, this is stereotyping, but, and
now, a couple things can be said about that. On the one hand, of course, Einstein's theory of relativity had pretty tough going right at the beginning because the concept of the speed of light being an absolute and mass not being an absolute,
mm-hmm.
Or a mass-energy relationship not being an absolute, was just so totally foreign.
Yeah.
So that in the early stages of, in the early part of this century, when the theory of relativity was first being batted around, it took a great deal of courage to affirm that as a possibility. Now that has become dogma,
really?
In the sciences. And the same type of determination and courage and rigidity that it took to adhere to that and say, okay, we're going to take this as an absolute and follow out all its implications, now then becomes the rigidity which has institutionalized the theory of relativity, so that if and when anomalies appear in our experience that cannot be explained by, cannot be clarified by the theory of relativity, it will take the same type of courage to break away from it.
We do the same thing in theology.
Yes.
Wonderful.
But we don't.
Wonderful.
But you sort of expect that of a theologian.
You expect theologians to be more rigid.
You think of something about questions. At one of my evaluations at seminary, I told the evaluating board that I had for every question answered, 10 more questions would come up. And they told me if that's how I felt, then they had done their job. And I see science as being the same way. A scientist was here this summer, a woman working on her PhD in Florida, and she said that constantly there are more and more and more questions, but there aren't all those rigid answers.
I'm glad you got back to that, because there's another important distinction between question and answer. Questions shape the direction we go.
Mm-hmm.
They are the leaders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so helpful about the Kuhn book. I mean, it's 1962, and it's just remade, the rigidity. I'm sure that fellow didn't pay attention to Kuhn's book, because if they had seriously taught Kuhn, friend through Kuhn, he wouldn't have said that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to break down people in the chemistry department. They said their whole lives, were just changed because of the uncertainty that they find out now. I suspect with him, he needs some sort of psychological absolute in his life, and he takes it by thinking that some tall theologians are probably as sophisticated as Jerry Falwell or Bob Jones or somebody. That's why I think you're a theologian who would think that no matter what, the scientists are all,
everything
too. He's a human, he might also have been suffering from the ego problem. Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, that doesn't make a difference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, the whole sense, politically, religiously, probably even scientifically, I'm not so familiar with science fiction, but it seems to me there's more and more of a tendency right now to nail things down. In a world in which there are so many uncertainties, I think more and more people are looking for the answers. And some absolute kinds of things, both probably, at least in the political, social, and religious world.
Can you give us some examples?
we talked a little while ago about the growing, you mentioned something about the growing phenomenon religion to tie down the last days, for example. The whole emphasis there to look at present time as the end time, and that the end time is coming close. The whole emphasis there to nail that down and to find scripture to, you know, to support that.
But they have always been streams in theological life. Every big revival, you know, that you have to say about seminary. But there's always been this end time thing with imminence in each one.
Would it also be fair to see, to take that same principle and say apply it to American foreign policy, that we're going through a period when we are concerned as a nation to depend on traditional, tried, and true means of conducting our foreign policy, rather than branching out and risking and experimenting? We put our energies into the well-known means, power and defense, and put considerably less energy into the training of people in diplomacy and the exploration of interpersonal relations and inter-social relations.
The teaching in Russian,
yeah.
I don't know if that was, I think so. Foreign policy is pretty functional. Who's really designing it? Now, you're thinking the foreign policy is really for the benefit of other people. And I think the foreign policy is for the benefit of people who have the best interest. But to me, it's working very well for people who are in control. The common people.
Wait until 1984.
Yeah, I would expect that.
What are you talking about? The white, rich Americans?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. For us, it's mostly in that regard.
Yeah. Well, for the ruling class, so there is no reason for them to want to change it.
You're right on that.
I think there's something else is that we live so rapidly now that we live more by reaction than we do planning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we live by reaction. We only have time to react.
I think it's time to get ready for dinner.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.